Second? I'm Andrew, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Andrew.
I'm super nervous right now. But that's okay. I'm just going to say what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. So my earliest memories are, and this is something I heard when I first got sober and I definitely related to, my earliest memories are like social anxiety. Like I can remember when I was a kid just like laying in bed, just like beating myself up for things that I'd said in the day or what I was doing or how I felt. And I've heard people say, and I definitely relate, that I didn't know how uncomfortable I was until I took my first drink, and I felt that relief. For me, it was definitely that sort of like white light experience. It actually wasn't alcohol. The first time I really, I'd tried drinking a little bit before that, but where I grew up, I grew up in Hollister, California, and there was a predominant Latino gang there that I hung out with, and so the first time I really got fucked up, I smoked PCP. I was like 12. And that was like the first time I felt that real relief. That really takes you out of yourself. So and I mean, I hit the ground running. I mean, I grew up also really Christian, and so I didn't really know about like social taboos at all around drinking. So I started drinking like right away in the morning. Because I loved it so much, I was like, why wouldn't I drink before I go to school, like, in the 8th grade? So, yeah, I mean, things got bad for me pretty quick. I got, you know, I felt like I needed to get drunk or high every single day. Drugs were a big part of my story. And, yeah, I mean, really, I was just trying to numb myself out. This song is, like, really cute. Trying to numb myself out as much as possible. And so, yeah, I mean, like, through high school, like, I can remember, you know, I was going to, like, a boarding school at the time, and I would, like, steal the school van and go into Santa Cruz and steal alcohol, and I used to dress in my, like, church outfit to steal alcohol, and, like, I got really good at stealing alcohol. And it was a necessity for me, so that's, like, the main reason I got good at it. And, yeah, I mean, I got expelled from that boarding school, like, 3 years in a row. It was a Christian boarding school, so they had to keep accepting me back and forgiving me. yeah, but it was just, like, it was bad. I mean, finally, like, by the time I was 18, I was 210 pounds when I started high school. And by the end of it, I was, like, 120. I just, like, wasn't eating. I had a lot of eating issues. I had a lot of eating issues as well. Yeah, I just was, like, really sick. And, I mean, like, because I kept getting caught, like, I couldn't really smoke weed and I couldn't really drink. And so I was drinking Robitussin, like, every single day. I would just, like, wake up in the morning and, like, I was working as a janitor at the school because, like, the school had, like, different jobs you could do. And I can remember shoving toilet paper, like, up my nose and having, like, a glass of cranberry juice and just drinking, like, a whole bottle of Robitussin at, like, 7 a.m. and just, like, tripping, like, all day. And my body was, like, physically rejecting it. But I needed something to be, you know, out of myself. And then, like, yeah, so I got expelled. And, like, I remember when I finally got expelled the last time. What happened was I went on a school field trip to Hearst Castle. And I jumped in the Hearst Castle pool, which apparently is, like, a really big deal if you do it. I didn't really realize it at the time. But people were, like, up in arms about it. Yeah. And, like, Monterey Bay Academy got forever banned from Hearst Castle. And it was, like, a really big to-do. And the dean on the last day that I was there, like, my mom was, like, just dissolving into tears and, like, the dean was like, you know, if you ever want to help, you can call me up and I can refer you to rehab. And I basically told him to go fuck himself. But it was only like 6 months after that that, like, I was just sick all the time. I was thinking about killing myself every single day. I was a really big burner, you know, so I was like, it was progressively getting worse and, like, I was getting infections and I was just, like, really a sick mess. And I think it's important to know, for me at least, and I've heard this in the rooms as well, like, I had a sort of philosophical ground that I stood on for drinking. Like, I really felt like it was my right to drink as much as I wanted and to kill myself. And if you saw things the way that I did, like, the objectively right way, you would drink too. And so, yeah, I mean, things just, you know, progressively kept getting worse. And then I ended up getting, like, I called that dean up, actually, and just, like, started crying, and he, like, referred me to this rehab. And I moved to Santa Cruz for a little bit, because I had gone there. I had been stealing the school van and going into Santa Cruz, so I felt somewhat familiar with the area. And I had, like, 11 months sober there. And then it occurred to me, I didn't have 2 consecutive days sober from 13 to 18. And so I thought, maybe things just got out of control. Maybe I just, like, lost my handle on things. Well, I'm not actually an alcoholic. And so I decided to move out of my sober living environment and move into a squat in Santa Cruz. And it was great. I mean, I remember the first time I, like, on the porch of the cafe that I was sitting at, I just, like, smoked a joint, and I just, like, had that sense of relief. I was like, what was I ever doing being sober? Like, what a mistake that was. And so I moved into that squat, and then we basically just, you know, smoked crack and meth and, you know, went to hardcore shows, and it was a lot of fun. I don't know. I mean, things really just, like, kept getting worse and worse and worse. And then I was in this really sick, like, parasitic codependent relationship during that time, and I lived with this girl for about a year. There was a couple. I moved around. I moved to DC for a little bit, and I moved around a little bit. Ended up in Portland, Oregon, and I mean, really, at that point, this is how I characterize my alcoholism: is that I was drinking probably less than ever before. I was drinking maybe like 3 times a week, you know, and I don't think I've ever been so depressed in my entire life. I thought I knew depression before that, but it was just that numb feeling, you know, where, like, I couldn't, like, brush my teeth or, like, get out of bed. I was just extremely depressed because I didn't have that anesthetic any longer. Mm-hmm. And so it just sort of occurred to me, like, why don't you try getting sober again? It's weird. It's like I'd gone to AA a couple times in that period after I relapsed, but I would mainly just go just because I liked AA in a lot of ways. Like, this is a weird place. Like, people are sort of really brutally honest here in a way that you don't see in a lot of places. And so actually I'd come here and write about people is what I was doing. Like, not in the mean way, but just sort of like, there's a lot of interesting people here. And so I decided to get sober again. And that was April 16th of 2008. Just last month I celebrated 8 years sober, which is cool. Which is crazy because, like, if you would have told me that I would be able to go this long without drinking, or that, like, I wouldn't think about drinking, I mean, like, I'd probably just say that, I mean, one thing I really believed when I first got here is that, like, maybe so-and-so had 10 years sober, maybe they had 20 years sober, but nobody loved alcohol as much as I did. And so it took listening to people's stories and relating in before I realized that you guys drink like I drink, and you guys need alcohol the way they need alcohol. And so, yeah, it's been amazing. So that first year sober that I had, I was extremely depressed. I know that a lot of people have, like, a pink cloud. My first time sober actually did feel a lot of relief. But, I mean, really, my first year sober this time around, I was extremely, extremely depressed. And I think that's important for me to talk about because I think that sometimes people can feel like, I felt this way at least, like maybe I was doing something wrong, like I wasn't working the steps correctly, but really the truth is I just did a lot of damage while I was out there drinking. And there's a lot of crazy things that happen, and I hurt a lot of people, and I hurt myself. And sometimes it just takes longer for some people than others, you know, to recover from that. Doesn't mean the experiences were harder or worse or better or anything like that. It just took me a long time to heal. So, my first year sober, I was just, like, really depressed. And I remember they said, you can do whatever you'd like in sobriety. Like, anything that you do when you're drinking, you can do sober. And I was so low, and so I was like, you know what? I'm going to go hitchhiking. And so that's what I did. I year sober, and I went hitchhiking. And I had an experience on that trip that I feel kind of changed my sobriety in a lot of ways. I was down in, like, the Salton Sea area, and I was going to go hop on a freight train. And I was just sort of staking out. I'd done it a couple times in Santa Cruz. There's a local freight that runs through. And I met this guy. I was sleeping on the side of the freeway, and I woke up, and he was just looking at me, and he had a totally shaved, he had just shaved head, covered from head to foot in tattoos, and he was just looking at me, which is, you know, it kind of freaked me out, honestly. And so I just sort of tried to ignore him and just, like, was reading, And he came up and he was like, oh, you know, what are you reading? And I told him, and he was like, oh, like, I read that too. And he just, like, we started shooting shit about it. Anyways, he ended up being, like, one of the most quick-witted people I've ever met in my entire life. And he told me his life story. Apparently, he had killed two people in a meth deal that had gone bad in Texas. And, like, it just got not that, like, that long ago. And I sat with him on the side of the freeway, and he, like, smoked meth for 2 days. And it just sort of occurred to me that, like, I don't know. It almost didn't even seem fair what had happened to this guy. And it sort of, like, made me recognize that, like, the things that I was doing now were going to sort of like lay the rest of the way that my rest of my life was. And so, you know, after that, I like went back up to Portland, Oregon, and I went back to school. And I also met my now wife on that hitchhiking trip as well. We've been married like 3 years. And yeah, I mean, my sobriety has just been phenomenal. How long do I have? 2 minutes? My sobriety has been, I mean, it's been shitty at times, of course. I mean, like, life is, like, ups and downs, and there's been times where I've been really low. But for the most part, like, for one, I mean, like, I don't think about drinking anymore. It's not even, like, on the radar for me. Does that mean if I picked up a drink, I wouldn't drink like an alcoholic? Absolutely not. I'd be just as sick as when I left off, I'm sure. But a lot of what I think about now is my relationships to people and in the world. There's this really good part in the 12 and 12 that I think about. And I actually read it almost every day for a long time. It was on page 115 in the 12 and 12. I'm not a big book thumper, but this is just like one that I really like was helpful to me. But basically it just says, like, we learn that overdependence on people is unsuccessful because all people are fallible, and even the best of them will let you down, especially when our demands for attention become unreasonable. And that's been a lot of my sobriety, is sort of like working my relationships with people. What are my expectations? And step three, I think, is something I think about. Is probably the hardest, the idea of, like, turning my will up. That's really unpalatable, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think I had to really ruin my life, be just, like, a shell of a person before I'd even be willing to consider something like that. So, yeah, I mean, today, like, I feel happy for the most part. Like, I feel present, you know, which is not something I ever really had. So yeah, thanks for letting me speak. And with that, I'll pass it off.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I skipped a paragraph here. Many of you thought you were going to get away without coughing up a buck, but in accordance with our seventh tradition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, we have no dues or fees, but we do have expenses like rent and refreshments. We are responsible for meeting our own meeting expenses. We are responsible for our own meeting expenses. There you go. So now Hales will speak for up to 40 minutes.
Oh, God. I usually a blabbermouth. Oh, I'm Hells, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm shaking from head to toe. I'm Irish. I was born in Dublin in Ireland, and my father was a raging alcoholic. He would come home drunk almost every night, crash the car into the front door or the side of the house or wherever, and then he'd come up the stairs and beat my mother practically to death almost every night. She was black and blue every single morning, and she used to say, "Shh, girls, Daddy's not feeling well." And she had powder on the bruises, you know. And that's how we grew up, whispering. I whispered all my way through school, you know, because I didn't want anybody to ask me, could they come to my house to play with me? Because they'd see what it was. It was such a horrible environment to live in. I hated every second of it. And then when it was bad enough, we decided to move. My dad lost his whole business. He had a very big factory that he owned. And you know, the two-car garage, like in the big book and everything. He lost absolutely everything. But we had no idea until he came home one day and said, "We have to move. I haven't paid the mortgage," or whatever it was, for months. So they went off and took us to Galway, which is in the west, and left us with our grandmother, and we were there for a couple of years, and they just said goodbye, see you later, and we thought we'd see him later at 5 o'clock that night. And 2 years later we saw my mother again, and she had a bump in the front. She was pregnant again, and he was still doing his thing, And he said, I've got a beautiful place in London. So I was so excited, you know, I was just so excited. And my sister, I have two sisters, but one of them, the closest one to me in age, we went across the Irish Sea on the ship when it was like, there was no stabilizers, literally. People were just vomiting all over. And I remember this man with a huge, big sweeping brush thing, like you do your car windows with, you know, coming and doing the slop over the edge. And the boat would go down. And I'm just amazed that we didn't end up drowned, you know, the two of us anyhow. But when we got to England, I remember being dramatic, like I still am, and I leaned down and kissed the ground and said, thank you, God, for bringing us to England. It's going to be wonderful now. And I was so excited to get to see our new flat. And it turned out it was one bedroom. And there were four children now, because my brother was born, and my mum and dad. And the landlord thought there was one new baby, and that was it. So there we were, homeless in England. And in the windows it said, excuse my word, but it said no N word and no Irish. For room for rent, no N word and no Irish. So, you know, it wasn't that I felt bad enough. It was just like I felt like the piece of crap, you know. And I was only a little girl, I was 11. So then I went to school and the other kids were just like constantly knocking my chair over because I had an Irish accent and just beating me up all the time. It was really miserable. So I completely stopped going to school. I'd sit in the park, summer, winter, whatever. Nobody ever said I wasn't there at school. They just, you know, nobody just paid any attention. And, you know, that's how it was really growing up. My mom was so busy trying to keep it together that she just couldn't, you know, take care of her kids. And luckily we were pretty good kids, so we kind of took care of ourselves. Until I was let go, you know. When I was let go at like 15, I moved out as soon as I could. And I moved to a place in Jersey in the Channel Islands, which is a little group of islands off the coast of France. It's 9 miles from, it's an hour by air from England. It's just right there, just this lovely little islands. And I lived in an island called Jersey. I met this man who was just, I thought he was just beautiful, like just someone had just painted this perfect man for me. And I just thought I was so ugly, and I was Irish, and I was just like one of those little crab things that didn't come out of their, you know, their shell. I just felt so horrible about myself that I couldn't believe it when he said, you know, did I want to go out? Did I want to go out? I think I just vomited about 10 times after the night before. And I wish I'd kept vomiting because he turned into my dad. He had two attempts at trying to kill me. They got him one time and I was in the hospital. I was 6 months pregnant and he threw me over the balcony and I landed two stories down at 6 months pregnant. And luckily I didn't lose the baby. And she's 50 today, you know. And it was just this horrible, horrible life, you know. And I said I'd marry him. I don't know why. I was scared because I felt so ugly, like I said before, and so different to everybody. So he said, you know, we're going to get married. And I said, okay. So I called my mom in London, and I said, Mom, can you come over? We're going to get married, you know. I was so stupid. I mean, really stupid. And she said, oh, no, honey, I can't. Daddy's not well again. So I could imagine her with her two big black eyes and a broken nose or something, which I was on the other end just like that, you know, broken ribs, broken jaw, everything broken, you know, that you could think of. So she decided not to come, and I understood. And then I got his book out, and I called his dad, which he didn't know I had that book. And she said, oh, I'd love to come, dear. Shall I bring his wife and two children? And apparently he'd been one of those that went out for milk and never came back, you know. So at the time I thought, oh my God, someone shoot me. It's the worst day of my life. This man that I love so much, who was a bastard, you know, a real bastard. But I didn't think that anyone who loved me could possibly be a bastard because I'd seen this turmoil at home all the time, you know. But it was actually the best thing that ever happened. So when the baby was 9 months old, I was just constantly, you know, like I would get a job at the front of the office, and usually after a couple of months, I'd be in the back where no one would see the black eyes and things like that, you know. And, you know, I just thought I have to get away from him. And I got away once, and I was beaten so badly that, you know, I could hardly speak, and the jaw was wired, and all this kind of thing. So I was really frightened to leave in case I got caught, because we're back in England now, you know. Anyhow, eventually, one day I woke up and I knew that God was in the room with me. I just knew. And I hated the nuns. I went to school with the nuns. They're horrible people, some of those old nuns. Old, horrible old nuns. Anyhow, you know, I've still got lumps and arthritis on the back of my fingers from the side of the ruler, for God's sake. And that's just for saying hello properly, improperly, you know. But I lost my train of thought. I woke up. I can't remember what I was going to say.
God was in the room.
Hmm?
You said God was in the room.
Oh, God came in, yes. Hello, God. He didn't tell me he was there, but I knew he was. And I turned around because I knew there was something special in that room with me. And I said to Michael, this man, you know, you're really good looking. And he was. And I said, and look at me. At that time, I weighed about 90 pounds. And I was black and blue. And I was just a nervous Nelly, you know, shaken all the time, frightened to talk to anybody and all that kind of stuff. And I said, you know, you don't need this. You don't need this baby, and you don't need me. You can go out and get yourself a beautiful girlfriend, and don't worry about us. And that was on a Wednesday. On Saturday, he packed his bags, and he was gone. If that wasn't God, of course, I was waiting to be shot instantly afterwards. You know, but I thought, oh, at least I'll have gone fighting, you know. But anyhow, I didn't have to fight, and he left. And, you know, he had me followed a little bit and everything. But as soon as I got away from him, my life changed. It changed for, I turned into a wild thing. And I was a wild thing in the 60s in London. You know, I made a record for Decca. I wrote a couple of songs and the music and stuff. And my record was played every Sunday night on the Decca Hour, you know, for an unusual sound from four London girls. And my dad, who's drunk in my mom's house, he said, turn that fucking rubbish off, you know. So that's the only decent thing I did in my whole life, and he's turned that fucking rubbish off, you know. So I kind of had to contend with that. So, you know, those kind of things made you want to leave home as soon as possible, and I did. So anyhow, I moved, I met this man, he was lovely, and not as lovely as the other one, but better looking actually, and nicer manner, and I don't remember ever being hit by him. And he told me his name was Johnny Walker, and that was funny, isn't it? Same as booze. And I'm thinking, Johnny Walker, that's not really, you know, I didn't put it together. And then he told me he lived with his grandmother, and I didn't put that together either. And then 2 years down the line, while I was visiting him in prison because he robbed Barclays, he told me that his name was Ernie Davis, and he lived with his wife. And I thought, I'm never going to find myself a decent man, you know. I'm just like this big thing with the light. Get me, I'm stupid, you know. And of course, then I'd drink more and I'd feel better about myself. Anyhow, I met someone who, I moved to America. And, you know, I just constantly drinking, and I was introduced to pot. I was introduced to cocaine. And once I had met cocaine, we were the best of friends, you know. But I was unstoppable. Every penny I made would go up my nose. And I often think, I was laying in bed the other morning thinking, how am I going to pay for that? I thought, wouldn't it be lovely if you could just stick your hand up your nose and all that money would come out that you snorted all over those years, you know? And of course, that's not going to happen, but if only you knew. But it was just, I lived for every day. I wasn't there for my child. I was there for her. She went to a private school. She wore a uniform, the whole nine yards. But emotionally, she had nobody. You know, she had other women, had children, she had them. But she didn't have me emotionally. And one of the reasons was that I didn't know how to be there emotionally, because my mom had never been there emotionally for any of us. And her mom had never been there emotionally for any of them. You know, so it was just how it goes down the line, down the line. Anyhow, I ended up marrying this guy that was about 8 years younger than me, and big mistake, big mistake. It's like now I had two children. Although some of the other things were nice, but, you know, he was gone in 9 months, and because I asked him to go, you know. And then I met someone else who was a bit older, and he worked flying airplanes for the funny people, you know, in the government. And I fell madly in love with this guy, and he with me. And that started my drinking and my drugging and my serious, you know, putting myself in terrible positions where I could get killed or murdered or whatever, you know. I lived in Harlem for a year by myself, and I would snort probably Ajax, whatever that is you clean the toilet with. I'd pay $100 for a line of Ajax, you know, that was on the back of the toilet, thinking it was the finest cocaine, as they told me. You know, I'd come out with a terrible headache. But, you know, my life was absolutely insane. And these little kids lied to me. They were probably this chap's age. They would hotwire the school bus and take me home from East 125th to 118th Street. You know, I felt like a queen picked up by the stolen school bus and dropped off at home. You know, it's lovely. And then I'd call everyone that I'd never met in my life, you know, that I might have passed by and say, come on over to my house, you know, free booze and pot and bring any drugs that you have. And that was it, you know. My whole life was around drinking and drugging and not feeling. I don't think I ever had a feeling. If I did, I was so quick to replace it with something to drink, you know. I slept with people's husbands. I didn't even feel bad about it. I feel bad about it now. You know, most of the wives are dead now, and I'm still going on. But at least, you know, I mean, they just say, don't make amends to the wives, you know, because you're going to piss them off, and it'll ruin their marriage if there's anything of it left. So, of course, I didn't do that. But these funny people that my husband worked for were actually, you know, had a lot of power in the United States. So I would go on the plane, there's one C-130s, those great big planes, you know, like the Army has, four engines, four propellers and all that. And we'd go on, the plane was called Juicy Lucy, and we'd go on Juicy Lucy as far as they could take me in the islands, and then they'd go to Angola or some other place in Africa, and they'd drop me off on some island, and like about a few days before they were coming back, I'd get a message from the tower. These were little tiny towers in these, some of these places, because they didn't fly into big airports where they normally would fly, you know. And I'd get a message, you know, Juicy Lucy's coming by on the 5th, be on the runway, you know. And that was my life. I'd be on the runway, like, you know, powder all over my nose, looking for this big airplane, thinking it was perfectly normal, you know. I mean, who else does that? And you know, I remember when the plane used to take off, I used to stand behind him, he was the captain, and I'd pretend I was skiing. And I thought I could really actually get off the ground without that plane. I was so high. I just said, this is the most wonderful life I've ever had. You know, here I am skiing, you know, above the ocean and everything, and just a complete lunatic. Lunatic. There was no space for any sanity, you know. And don't ever say, you know, do you think you should have done that to me? Because I would just attack, you know, like, how dare you talk to me like that or something. How dare you? I don't do any drugs and I don't drink more than anybody else, which, of course, is a complete lie. I remember I woke up one night and I was in Florida. The plane came home and we were in this hotel in Florida. And I went down to Florida from New York, because we lived in Manhattan at that time, to meet the crew and everything. And they came into this little private airfield, and then they came over to the hotel, and I was waiting for them. So the thing was, we'd usually sit down and have about 20 drinks, you know, and then we go and have dinner, and then we have another 20 drinks, and they talk about bullshit and the airplane and all that stuff all night long, and I couldn't care less as long as they kept talking and I could keep drinking, you know. Well, one night, my husband said, I'm not having a final. That's enough finals. Because I said, just one more final. That was like the 10th time, you know. So that's all I remember, except when I woke up. And I remember I was on the floor, and I tried to move my mouth, and I couldn't because there was a gag in my mouth. And I tried to move my arms, and I couldn't because they were tied behind my back. And I tried to move my ankles or my feet, and I couldn't because they were tied together too. And then I looked down and I had no clothes on. So I thought, this is really a situation that I have to get out of. How did that happen? I was at the bar saying, final. How did I get here? You know? And I just thought, well, there's a lump in the bed over there. They're waiting. They're taking a nap before they do me in, you know. So I managed to get up to the door like this, because it's hard when you're gagged and bound and your hands are behind, you know. And I got this big hotel door open by all this stuff and coming back, and then it slammed and hit me on the ass. And I'm out in this big, long, long, long corridor, three times as long as this room. So I started hopping. Hoppity, hoppity, hop, all the way down, hoping that a door would open, praying that one wouldn't. I didn't know what I wanted. So I hopped into the foyer, and it was like my 15 minutes right there and then. Like, everybody who ever worked there in the men's department of the hotel anyhow was, what happened? Oh, poor lady, what happened? And I'm gagged. I have no clothes on. What do you think fucking happened? You know? So I don't know. to bring a curtain or something out and give it to me, you know. But, I mean, it was just ridiculous how they kept talking to me and I kept, you know, talking back. And so they called the police, and these two awful. Well, there were two eggs on legs. I don't know if they could have caught me if I'd ran, to be quite honest, but they were policemen, and their bums were hanging out of the back of their trousers. It was really disgusting. It looked like a joke on Floridian police officers. You know, it was like a skit. So they said, what's the matter? And they looked at me, and they kind of, and then the manager told them to go down. I said, I just woke up on the ground, and someone in the bed tried to murder me. That's what I felt, you know. So I could see them rolling their eyes as they went down the corridor, and they came back about 20 minutes later. And I went, well, where's the person? And they go, do you want to shut the fuck up now, or do you want to come in the back of the car with us? And I thought, now that would be something that I'd have to kill myself after if I went in the back of the car with these two tubbies, because I knew I'd never see daylight or the police station. You know, I'd be dumped somewhere else. And I said, no, what's my option? They said, you can just stay in another part of the hotel. And the ship's funds, which was the airplane funds, was thousands and thousands of dollars, because it cost $3,000 for a little bag of ice in the jungle, you know, if you can imagine that. And I'm not exaggerating. So these policemen went off quite a bit richer than when they came in that night and left me in a room with the security guard outside. And I stayed in there for 2 days. I never heard, it turned out the lovely person who'd done that to me was my husband, who said that I'd gone completely insane and was looking for my contact lenses, which were actually in my eyes while I was looking for them. So it was very difficult to find them, isn't it? They're already in there. So, he just said she's a crazy person, and, you know, she's just crazy, psycho. And they believed him. And so I stayed in that room. I called everybody I ever met in this life. I remember it was like $5,000 or something, the phone bill from that room, for just for me calling people and telling them that I was locked in this room and a security guard and I hadn't done anything. And of course, I'd gotten drunk and out of hand and had nervous breakdowns and everything else. So that's kind of how it was getting worse and worse and worse, you know. And it's just, even against the other wives, some of them were okay, but I was the one that became a total blackout drinker. I'd never know when it was going to happen, and I'd never know when it started. But I'd end up, one time I ended up in another country. I remember drinking in Oakland Airport after seeing someone off, and I had flight privileges, so I didn't have to pay a lot to get on airplanes and stuff. But I'd apparently been dropped off by a United flight in Belgium. And I woke up in this hotel, and I was looking out the window, I thought, what happened? And I looked out and everything was in French. And I thought, someone's playing a joke, you know. Someone's playing a joke. They put posters outside the hotel window so that I think I'm in France or something. And then the doctor came in. And it was a Belgian doctor. And he said, I feel so bad for you. He was just like, I thought it was Jesus when I opened my eyes and he was standing up looking at me, because he had big, beautiful blue eyes and long hair. And he was so gentle and everything. So I thought I died. I didn't know whether I'd gone to heaven or hell yet, but it was hell afterwards. But he just, how did you get like this? I said, I don't know. I was having a drink in Oakland, and this is where I ended up. I couldn't even remember going into the hotel and getting a room and all that stuff. I mean, it was complete blackouts. I couldn't remember if I'd met anybody and maybe had sex. God forbid, you know, I'd feel sorry for them. But anyhow, my life was like that, you know. And then, there were so many things. Like, I decided that I wanted to have flying lessons. And I was in California at that time. And there's a little airport out there, Hayward Airport. It's like, it's not where the big jets come in or anything. So this guy out there, his dad had been killed in an airplane out there. So, of course, I picked the one whose dad had gone down in flames, you know, to teach me how to fly. And it turned out that he would give me free lessons in exchange for probably sex, which I wasn't interested at all in sex, not with him anyhow. And certainly the 30,000 mile high club would never happen with this fatso. But anyhow, I just thought, you know, we're going along, and he keeps talking. And I can't concentrate. Before you know it, I was on the runway and off in the bushes in Hayward. And I remember getting out of the cockpit and sliding off the wing and running down the thing, the runway. and going into the bar and begging for a margarita. That's all I could think of. I have to have a drink, because that was a nightmare, you know. And, you know, anyhow, how much time do I have?
17.
Oh, my God. I have to tell all my secrets. But anyhow, so I married this guy, and we had a really good marriage, I suppose. You know, I mean, he was gone most of the time, so that made it even better. And I had this really nice apartment in Manhattan, and, you know, he was gone for a month and home for a month. And then he was gone for 3 months and home for a month. So I didn't really feel that I had a husband. But during that time, something happened. I was in a bar one night, and I'd go in there at 5 o'clock for every night, pretending I'm going in for happy hour. This had been for 2 years. It's like, they don't know. I'd like, is this happy hour? Oh, sit down, like the lunatics here, you know. So I sit down and I say, I'll have this. And then the bartender was the bartender. He was always there. And, you know, happy hour would go by and everybody would leave and it would be just me and him. And he tried to set me up with a few people. But the last person he set me up with, he said, you kind of scared him. He said, what was that language you were speaking? And I said, I don't know, I just speak a little bit of Gaelic, a little bit of French, and a little bit of Spanish. Did I have a whole conversation? He said, oh yeah, for hours. And I thought I was a devil. I thought the devil was, like, I was speaking in tongues or something. So he said, tongues. And I said, oh my God, the devil. And that scared the shit out of me. And I went out, left that bar immediately. I went to another one. But anyhow, you know, I was back in that bar again the next night. And I said, I noticed he had a big ring on. And it had, like, 33 written on the little ring, on the big ring. And I said, what's that, Frank? And he said, have you been married 33 years? And he goes, oh, no. He said, I've been sober 33 years. And I said, oh, my God. He's a bartender. 33 years. I mean, that's pretty amazing, you know, 5 minutes for me. And so he said, let me give you another drink, honey. And he used to give me these big, I swear to God, they were, you could have, three goldfish could have lived in there for a month. They were that big. The big, huge goldfish full of wine. Goldfish bowl. And I said to him, just out of the blue, I said, Frank, do you think I have a problem? And he goes, oh, no, honey, have another drink. So that's the best news ever. It's like winning the bloody lottery, you know. So I said, oh, thanks, Frank. I was kind of worried about that. And he said, yeah, no, you're fine. He said, Bernie's going to come in tomorrow. He wants to meet you again and take you for dinner. He knew I was married, this guy. He'd been sober 33 years, this guy. But he wanted me to meet Bernie, who was a gangster. And Bernie was, like, a really nice guy and everything, but I wasn't interested in gangsters at that time. Earlier, and when I was drinking, I didn't mind a gangster now and then. I worked in a nightclub where gangsters, you know, would come. 10 minutes, thanks. And they'd give me huge tips. You know, so that was great. I never said anything to anyone about what business they did or anything like that. So after him telling me that, I remember coming home and I tried to get into the Mexican restaurant next door. I was on 8th Avenue and 56th Street. And I knocked on the door and they're going, because I remember a couple of nights before I'd been in there, like 3 a.m. or something, and some poor sod was on the end of the bar, you know, in the corner, the last seat in the corner, trying to enjoy his misery all by himself. And I decided that I was going to cheer him up, whether he liked it or not. So I started cheering him up, and I don't know, I felt funny when he asked me if I wanted to go to a party. I actually thought he was going to murder me because I'd ruined his night. But I went to the party. Well, I got as far as the cab. And then we're in the cab, and my insanity comes out, and I said, you're taking me to one of those sex swap parties. Poor guy goes, he just leaned across me, opened the door, and shoved me out. Now, I did roll. I didn't have any bruises, but I just, you know, rude, into the bar that was next to me and had another drink and told, oh, the poor bartender was going to give her a fucking drink and shut her up. This man did this to me. Oh, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, I was just a big hemorrhoid, a pain in the ass. That's what I was to everyone who ever met me when I was drinking. They couldn't wait to get rid of me, you know. So anyhow, I tried to get into the Mexican restaurant, Cancun. And I'd been to Cancun itself, and I think I was thrown out of there too. I can't quite remember how I left, but I know I came in a lot different to how I was let out. And they wouldn't let me in, so I came home. and I just went to bed. And I woke up the next morning, and I'd had quite a few drinks. I used to have some cocaine or Ajax, whatever you prefer to call it. And then I'd have something to smoke, and then I'd have drinks all in between, trying to change the way it was going. And it was always going this way, you know. And it was going this way, I knew I was in trouble, even though I didn't know it at the time, because I knew I was going to be in a big blackout thing, you know. But so I woke up and I walked over to the phone and I said, "Hello, do you know where there's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting anywhere? Like I'm a professor doing a paper on AA, you know." And she goes, "Yeah, there's one down the street. Where are you?" And I told her, and she said, "It's 10 minutes and it starts in 15. It's 10 minutes walk and it starts in 15 minutes. And I went. And that was July the 18th, 1988. So I was 45, I'm 73 now, and I'm coming up on 28 years. Mm. And believe me, I am the most willful person. I have pained myself, I stuck my head in the gas oven even, you know, and a dog saved my life. He smelt the gas and his owner broke the door down and they had to bring me back. But rather than, and this was while I was drinking still, but, you know, I suffer from depression. Right now I have a lung disease, which I'll probably die of. I mean, it could last 5 minutes or 50 years if I live that long, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have back problems. I have a lot of things that are happening to my body, and they just move me into an old people's home. So I'm not happy about being there at all, you know. If anyone even brings up the subject of depends to me, I'm going to knock them out right there and then. Depends on those lovely diapers they give to old ladies like me. So I said, I'm not going to have that, you know. And, you know, I've been fighting it since I moved in. It's a terrible adjustment to me. You know, when you turn, I'm 73, which is, you know, it's amazing I'm 73. I thought I'd be long gone by the time I was 40, you know, and I prepared myself for that. But 73 in a young mind, the body's all fallen apart, you know, and saggy where they shouldn't be, and there's hair where there shouldn't be, and none where there is. And all this, everything, and instead of in my bathroom cupboard, there's Preparation H instead of Chanel No. 5. You know, there's all these different things that change your wardrobe from a young person to an old person, you know. But I still have a great sense of humor, and I still have a lot of laughs in me. And, you know, I got sober, and I've never had a drink since. I don't want any applause for that, because really, it's just a gift from God. I set my mind to it. My mother was murdered. I didn't drink. I waited around the corners until the woman came out and I wanted to kill her with the car, but I didn't. I had breast cancer. I didn't drink. Instead, I came to the rooms. I was living in Manhattan when I had breast cancer, and I just walked into the meeting and I said, 5 minutes, and I said, thank you. And I just said, you know, I was told I have breast cancer today, and I was surrounded by women and some men, and I was carried through the whole thing like a princess, you know. And every problem I've ever had, if I'm honest enough and go to meetings and tell the truth and be good to other people and do service, mm-hmm. It's really not a big deal, you know. This is a free life. I've got this beautiful, free life. I wake up in the morning and I can do whatever I want. I don't have to think of, oh my God, who is that? You know? Because there's none of that in my life anymore. I'm totally divorced. My husband died after he divorced me. Must have been the shock. But anyhow, so I guess, you know, I want to thank Guillermo for asking me to speak. And I really feel blessed to be able to speak here and carry the message. So thank you.